Blog Talk Radio.
Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade Justice, in for another program to share constructive information on racism, white supremacy, what it is, and how it works. Thank you for tuning into the broadcast. I hope you get constructive information. And again, if you do not find the broadcast to be of use to you, please invest your time and energy elsewhere. We do not want black people wasting time. This broadcast always say global system of racism, white supremacy. I have been pointing that out. Non-white people worldwide are suffering from dealing with the system of white supremacy. Keep that in mind. You should be able to communicate with tons of non-white people about this problem to try to come up with strategies. I've also said repeatedly, London, England has sent a massive amount of traffic to this site. That is the second most popular city for sending visitors to the cows. We have a lot of folks listening out there. I hope they are black folks. And today we got a guest from your area of the world. Real pleasure to have him on the broadcast, and I want to make sure that I recognize Ross 43, listener in the United Kingdom. He informed me about today's guest, and I think he has a lot of excellent information. I think the broadcast will speak for itself. But thank you very much, Ross 43. I hope you can call the program at some point and share your experiences as well. Our guest for today's broadcast. He is a black male man. Incredible body of work. He has essays. He has books. The website is linked in the program. You can click his name. It'll take you right to his website. The address for those not listening at Blog Talk Radio is houseofknowledge.org.uk. Again, houseofknowledge.org. .uk. A plethora of books, some of the titles, Buy Now, Pay Later, different book, Why Willie Lynch Must Die, outstanding work, Sankofa and His Amazing Friends, one of the books we're going to look at today, Niggers, Negroes, Black People, and Africans. He also wrote Saving Our Sons. He has a plethora of essays on his website that you can check out. We're going to try and break down some of those today. And more importantly, this is what he said to me in the email. He had agreed to come on the program, but he said, finally, as you may have gathered if you have read my work, I am very much interested in promoting and implementing solutions to our problem. Hence, while I appreciate the need for our people to understand the workings and manifestations of the belief system called white supremacy, I am even more keen for us to create viable solutions to liberate ourselves. Hopefully, this broadcast will be very much solution-oriented. Our guest live from the United Kingdom, Paul Ifeomi Grant. Mr. Grant, are you with us?
Okay, Brother Gus, I'm here. Greetings to yourself and all your listeners, and thank you very much for having me on the show. It's, I'm always pleased to be able to communicate with our people across the pond, you know, and whether it be in the United States or in the Caribbean or in Africa or anywhere in the world, it's always good if we can share our ideas and experience and we can see the commonality of our experiences as well as the differences and nuances and, you know, create strategies for improving our life experience.
Outstanding. For our listeners, particularly those folks stateside, this might be their first time hearing about your work. Could you just give a little bit more background information about what you do and why you got into this work?
Okay, well, I'm not quite sure where you want me to start, if you want it just to be about the writing or about who I am as a person. I mean, what do you prefer?
Could you give us a little bit of both?
Okay, well, I'm 44 years young, feeling good, vegetarian. I was born in London. My parents are Jamaican, both from rural Jamaica, from Marcus Garvey's parish, St. Anne. They came to UK. I've got an older brother and sister. I was born in London, as I said, and schooled there. I wasn't educated, but I schooled in London. Pretty much, you know, fairly unremarkable life, you know, kind of growing up in London and being brought up to be what I'd call pro-black, but not necessarily African. Went through the school system, got a degree in applied chemistry, set up a business and recruitment consultancy. Unfortunately, went into business with the wrong person, so I had to close that business and had to get a job, which I didn't really like doing. Thankfully, I no longer have a job. But worked various jobs and kind of climbed my way up the kind of ladder, I suppose, to a quite senior position in the last job I had. Worked in prisons, but in 1995, I suppose, there was a transformation point in my life. Was doubly. One, I got married in 1995 to my wonderful wife, and secondly, I also read Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams, which is what I call my secular epiphany. That book really just changed my life. I'd been looking for something, but I didn't know what it was I was looking for. And they do say that when the student is ready, the master will appear, or the teacher will appear, and Chancellor Williams came into my life, even though I think he'd deceased by that point. And from that point, I became an African. and then I began to read and read voraciously and trying to make up for the, at that point, obviously I was 29 years old, so I kind of felt like I'd wasted many years of not knowing, so I'd spent the last 15 years just trying to research and catch up for as much of the time I missed out on. And I think from there I've moved forward and been engaged in a number of different community organizations, working with young people, working with adults, set up a community economic development company in 96 called the African Business Development Fund. So we, African, do invest together, became a limited company in 2001. So there's 118 of us involved in that. That was kind of based on the principle of partner, which some of your listeners may not be familiar with that because it's kind of more common in the Caribbean, but some if they're from Caribbean or Africa, sometimes known as Susu or boxing money. It's just Amos Wilson writes about it in Destruction, in Blueprint for Black Power. The technical phrase is rotating credit association, but it's known in Jamaica as partner. And we kind of used that principle and created the ABDF. And people, again, can find the website in my books, or if they want to look for ABDF, African Business Development Fund, which is www.abdf.co.uk. Joined a group called Nubian Link with some brothers I met, and we do summer school programs for 12 to 15-year-old African boys and girls every year. We've been doing that for about 15 years. We do Kwanzaa celebrations. I also ran Rites of Passage program for about 10 years with another group called Brother to Brother. These are self-funded groups. We all put our money in and fund the activities in those groups. Also, I set up a parent support group in 1998, so we represent children being excluded from school. So that's been, we've represented hundreds of parents over the years. We also have a JEGNA program linking adults with young people and supporting them. And then I started to write books in 2003. I wrote my first book, Niggers, Negroes, Black People and Africans, which was really, I suppose, twofold. One, I felt I had something to say. I felt that there wasn't enough books being written by Africans in the UK, sort of detailing our particular life experience. I mean, a lot of the books I've read are by Africans from the US and have given me a lot of knowledge and information, but I thought there was our story from this perspective over here needed to be told to kind of add to our worldwide story. And there were some issues I felt that I could add maybe something a bit, if not new, maybe a slightly different angle in it, and maybe we'll cover some of those today. So I wrote my first book in 2003, and I've now written six books. Also published a pamphlet, which is called Let's All Pull Together, which is a critique of capitalism and socialism, and also produced some DVDs and CDs. And I've actually been to the US, actually, and given some lectures there. So some of my DVDs are actually filmed in the US, as well as in Netherlands and Africa as well. And yeah, I've got two children, Juwanda and Abiba, who are 13 and 9, and they're wonderful, and my wife is wonderful, so I've got a very good life.
Wow. Outstanding. Want to hop into it and get to some of these suggestions and solutions. You pretty much already shared, you are a black male, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm an African, black, whatever, yeah.
Okay. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms interchangeably, same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
Yeah, I believe that both a system and a belief system, because I consider it to be, it's almost quasi-religious in a way, in the way it operates. I suppose I would maybe nuance it a bit, but as a general overall framework, then yes, there is that belief system, and it does operate, and it does function in the way which you described, even though the definition of white sometimes changes, which maybe we can talk about. But I know that that belief system operates, and it's been operating from my research, at least 3,300 years in a systematic way.
Wow. I guess, what definition do you use, if you don't mind sharing, for white supremacy?
I haven't got a written down definition. I suppose, because I said, what my focus is on is about the empowerment of African people. And in the way in which the world operates at the moment, whilst those people who classify themselves as white or Caucasians may be at the moment the dominant group, we have to also recognize the nuances in terms of how people identify themselves. So most people do not, from my experience, identify themselves as non-white as their key identification of themselves, even if they are, in effect, non-white. Most people have a narrower definition, which may be based on religion, which may be based on their national grouping, or may be based on kind of racial identities. They might consider themselves to be Asian, they may consider themselves to be black or African, etc. So in terms of how their loyalties will operate, we will find that many of the people who may also be subjected to this system of racism may also not necessarily operate as the friends of African people. So I'm kind of interested in us having a kind of what I may call more nuanced understanding of how the world functions in the face of the fact that there is this kind of this system which is oppressive force, which is used by people who consider themselves to be white, and sometimes used unknowingly because it's part of the culture, it's embedded within the culture, And although, I mean, I think I've identified about six different dominant kind of explanations for why this system or operates or how it came to be, but whichever one of those six, you know, including Francis Cress Wilson's one, which I know you you probably cited, but whichever those six you may kind of choose to think is the correct one, the reality is that we're faced with an oppressive system. We have to work out how we're going to disarm or negate that power and overthrow that power.
Agreed. I want to get to some of the solutions, but I do think it's important. And I also want to let folks know, I see someone called in with a hand. Be patient. Hang out. I will get to the phone lines. Just be patient. I see you. Call the last four digits, 3413. I want to get to some of these solutions, but I do want to take a moment because you are in the United Kingdom. Can you kind of talk about some of the differences, idiosyncrasies in how racism, white supremacy operates in your area of the world? You said you've been to the States. Can you maybe talk about some of those differences?
Okay, yeah, sure. I mean, I was born in London and grew up in London. Now, in terms of the African population, I mean, the African population in the UK or black population, whichever term you prefer, I'll use African if people recognize I'm talking about black people, and that's fine. It's changed a lot since I was born, and even in the last 20 years. I mean, after the sort of second European tribal war, which they call World War II, when it ended in 1945, in Britain, they had a labor shortage due to the number of men who'd been killed or injured in that war. So they went round to their colonies, particularly starting off in the Caribbean, requesting for people to come over to work. So, you know, we weren't kind of, my parents' generation weren't coming over as sort of like illegal immigrants. I know you've got this big thing about people crossing the border to the US and holding up a debate about that. But literally the British were going over and requesting people to come and work in the National Health Service, on the railways and in various other parts of particularly the public sector, but also in factories and other places on the transport system. So from 1945, they call it the Windrush generation, named after a ship called the Windrush, which brought the kind of first group of emigrants into the UK from the Caribbean. Now, obviously, there's been an African population, a black population in Britain dating back hundreds and thousands of years. But if you're talking about more recent history, that's when you've got a big influx of Africans from the Caribbean coming into the UK from 1945, probably up to kind of the late 60s in terms of the major numbers coming. So when people talk about sort of the black population, when I was growing up, it was overwhelmingly from the Caribbean, and the biggest portion of that was from Jamaica. Now, what's happened in the last sort of particularly 15 to 20 years, particularly last 15 years, that you've had now much larger numbers of Africans coming from Africa, from the continent. So the kind of demographics have changed in terms of black population. So now actually the biggest black group within the UK are Africans from the continent, or who are born in the UK whose parents are from the continent. So they're now slightly bigger than Africans from the Caribbean. And then you've got a growing, what they call, you call maybe called biracial or mixed race population in the UK, which is now more than just over half as big as the African Caribbean population. And that's mainly as a result of African Caribbeans having relationships with white people. Initially overwhelmingly men, but now increasingly women as well, and we might get into that later. The population in the UK is about at least half, probably more, of the black population is located in London. London's got about 7 million people out of a total population in the UK of about 60 million. So London's a huge city in terms of the overall population, in terms of the economy and the size, and obviously lots of people are attracted to London, and that's where lots of African people went when they came. So London's got well over half of the black population. Then you've got Birmingham following that, which is, I think, has got about 70,000 Africans. And after that, you've got really quite small population. So it's nothing like the US in terms of population concentration. And even in London, we're talking about African people maybe being just over 10% of the population in that city. So we've got nothing like Detroit or, you know, those kind of population concentrations, or as it used to be in New Orleans, where it's sort of 60, 70% of the population being African. So we've, even in the places where we're most concentrated, we're still a relatively small minority. This has had different effects. One, we haven't had residential segregation, or at least not formal residential segregation, the way you had in the US, where you had very distinct, this is a black area, this is a whatever area, Chinese or Italian. So that residential segregation hasn't happened, even though you had some population concentrations in certain areas of African people. So that's meant that the kind of process of assimilation is happening much quicker in the UK than it's happened in the US. You know, there wasn't any need for sort of this school busing like you had, because when you went to school, like the school I went to, the majority of the people were Caucasians. Although, you know, we kind of, a lot of the Africans then, we stuck together. That's the experience of most African children. There are schools in London where you do have a majority, say, African pupils. That's normally where the whites have run away from the area. But still, in terms of the general areas, there isn't an electoral seat in terms of the parliament that's majority African or anything near it. So it's very, very different than the US in terms of demographics. We're about 1.2 to 1.5% of the population in this country, as opposed to, I think your figures are 12 or 13%. You're talking about 1 and a bit million, maybe 1.5 million, depending on who, how you count the mixed population. So it's between 1.2, 1.5 million maybe, as opposed to your 35 to 40 or whatever million that people cite. So there's a very different kind of mix in terms of demographics, and it has a different impact on rates of assimilation in the UK.
Wow, I want listeners, we're trying to, attempting to cultivate very attentive, critical listeners here at the COWS. Keep that in mind when we get back to the discussion of sexual intercourse between black people and white people. They have relatively low numbers of black folks in the UK. Keep that in mind, particularly what Mr. Grant shared about how they count the so-called mixed population, non-white people who have one white parent and a non-white parent. Keep that in mind. I want to hop to some of the essays, if that's all right with you, Mr. Grant. You have just outstanding essays, and these are available for listeners if you go to Mr. Grant's website, houseofknowledge.org.uk. Excellent essays. I want to start with economics. You have a quote at the beginning of the paper. I'll read it for the listeners. The most dangerous of all dependencies is to depend on your wealthy oppressor to free you and share wealth with you, because wealthy people and nations never train poor people and nations to take wealth away from them. This is John Henry Clark, adapted by Paul, if I only Grant. Can you kind of talk about our economic situation under racism, white supremacy, and tips for black financial empowerment?
Okay, well, I mean, that's kind of, in a way, a subject of a whole book, you know, to my latest one, Buy Now, Pay Later. But to try and, I'll try and be as brief as I can, and if you need to interject for brevity or for clarification, you know, feel free to do so. I suppose what I was trying to highlight there, I mean, particularly we have this reparations movement that's I know up and running at the moment in the US and also in the UK. And one of the things I've been trying to explain to or suggest to people is that, as John Henry Clark said, there's never been in history a powerful people who've voluntarily given up power, and whether you see that as being military power, economic power, the two often interlinked, to a people who they've conquered. People only give things up that they value when they have to or are made to. There's no instance of Europeans or Caucasians ever having some sentimental feeling of, well, we've done wrong to some people, we need to treat them right. Whenever they've made reparations, for example, we look at examples of reparations that Europeans have engaged in. They gave reparations to Japanese who were interned in the United States. Now, that didn't cost them very much money at all, because there wasn't particularly large numbers of Japanese. Two, the level of internment wasn't very long in terms of duration. So again, that meant that the kind of level of compensation didn't have to be huge. Three, it was in their own interest, because they wanted to cultivate Japan as a capitalist economy and bring them into that that system. So that was a one way of building bridges with Japan after they've, of course, dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan. So another instance is Native Americans in the United States. Reparations are paid to Native Americans. They still get money to stay in there, and they've got these casinos that they're allowed to have on their concentration camps that are called reservations. Now, again, that's a drop in the ocean, the amount of money that's given to Native Americans. Now, if you then turn around to, for example, Germany and Israel, Germany's had to pay out huge amounts of money to Israel because the Caucasians in Israel, who call themselves Jews, are a very powerful and influential group of people within the United States and have massive and disproportionate influence on their foreign policy. So Germany's had to pay numerous amounts of reparation payments. If you read a book by, if you read books by a writer called Norman Finkelstein, who himself is a white Jew and whose parents died in the during the Holocaust. I mean, he's been attacked by many Zionists and their supporters because he tells the truth about the whole scam that's being played around compensation. He's got a book called The Holocaust Industry. And I'd recommend your listeners to read that book because it gives a wonderful exposition of how this whole guilt trip is being used to allow not only Israel to continue with its atrocities, but also he contrasts the way in which the kind of rhetoric that's used about the rationale for Jewish reparations is considered to be ridiculous when it's used in terms of reparations for Africans. But the whole point of it is that the United States, the European countries, they could not afford to pay the kind of reparations for what was done in the Maafa, if I could quote Maureen Brandy, to Africans. It would be trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, and they could not afford to do it, so they're not going to do it. Reparations is not a matter of law, it's a matter of power. You can have any law you want on the statute book. If you don't have the power to enforce it, it's meaningless. And the example I keep giving to our people is that people sometimes say the reason Europeans won't pay reparations is because slavery wasn't illegal when it was going on. But all the components of enslavement of Africans, kidnapping, torture, murder, rape, these are all illegal in the European countries and the United States and other white-dominated countries who are involved in that practice. So all those aspects are illegal. So it doesn't matter whether the act is illegal or not. What matters is who has the power to enforce the law, just like lynchings were illegal. Murder was illegal in the United States during the lynching period. That didn't stop lynchings taking place. It's about the power to enforce it. So reparationists, you know, particularly African reparationists, need to understand that reparations that needs to take place is internal repair. If we look at the word reparation, look at the root in terms of repair, what we need to do, we need to repair ourselves and go for a process of healing and repairing ourselves. And as I've said repeatedly to people, that we will only get reparations from Europeans when we don't need it. That is to say, when we have enough power in the world to be able to enforce our will, then we could make them give us reparations. But of course, when we get enough power in the world to enforce our will, we won't need it because we'll have become truly liberated then. So when I talk about economics, just to kind of pull it back together, economics is simply about the process of being able to meet the material and non-material needs of your people. So if you're not able to food, clothe, and shelter yourselves, as Africans in the United States are unable to do and Africans in the UK are unable to do, you know, I mean, I think famously Claude Anson's talked about, you know, can we manufacture underwear? Can we manufacture shoes? You know, can we do the most simple, basic things for ourselves as a people? If you're not able to provide for your basic needs, then you're in a position of dependency. And the lifeline, or to use a more kind of vivid metaphor, the white breast can be withdrawn at any moment. If you take the breast away from a baby, it dies. Since we're economically like a child on the white economic breast, if that's withdrawn, then we can be left in a situation of deep poverty and starvation, which you're seeing spreading during this global depression.
Wow. Again, context of white supremacy, our guest, Mr. Paul Ifeaomi Grant. I wanted to make sure I tossed out a few suggestions from your essay. A couple of the ones that I found to be really important, you said understand the difference between wealth and income. Could you kind of deconstruct that a little bit?
Okay, well, I think a classic example which people can relate to would be sport. If you look at, you know, what you call football, what we call American football, if you look at what you call soccer and what we call football over here, if you look at these, you see a disproportionate number of Africans engaged in, you know, the NFL, earning sometimes huge amounts of money, and similarly in what they've got over here, the Premier League, the Football League, you know, what you call soccer. Again, Africans earning anything up to now, gosh, £150,000 a week in wages, which would be, gosh, you work it out, so about $225,000 a week. Some of the top football players or soccer players are earning. Now, that is income, very, very high income. But the reason why it can be translated into wealth, I mean, if you earn that amount of money as income, and if you earn cents, and you can translate that into wealth. But the thing that you need to understand is, and which obviously many of those individuals don't understand, is they won't be earning that amount of money for the rest of their lives. I think I saw a statistic saying that 60% of NFL players are broke within 5 years of retirement. So what they have is very high levels of income, but they don't have wealth, because a person with wealth has what you call residual income, which is income which comes to them when they don't have to do anything. They don't have to do any work to have that money coming in. To give you an example, if you have 50 properties and you're renting them out, I mean, you could have an agent managing it for you. Every month, money comes into you, and you don't actually have to do anything in order for that money to come in. If you have royalties on a song that you've recorded, every time the song is played on the radio, royalty money comes into you as residual income. You don't have to go and make the song again. If the song's been a big hit, the money just keeps coming in. Same with publishing rights. You know, if the book is published, it can be reprinted numerous times and money can keep coming into you. You write the book once or you publish the song once if you own the copyright to that. So if you have residual income, then you have money coming into you when you're sleeping, when you're showering, when you're relaxing, whatever you're doing. If you're an American football player or a British soccer player, when you get to the point where you can't run fast anymore, you're not as powerful as you were, and you stop kicking the ball or catching it or blocking people, your income stops immediately. So then what you're left with at the age of 30 or however long you last, and I think the average life career expectancy for an NFL player is only something like 4 or 5 years, I think. But let's say you can make it to 30 until you've had, say, an 8-year career from coming out of college 22 to 30. What you've earned in 22 to 30, if you haven't developed any other skills or any other income streams, that then has to be really look after you for the rest of your life. So you've moved from being a very, very high earner in terms of income, having a very high income, to suddenly having zero income unless you put in place other ways for you to earn beyond your retirement. So that is the difference between having income and having wealth. Now, some football players and some sports people do translate their high income into wealth, but many blow their money and live a lifestyle as if they're going to be earning $5, $6, $7, $8 million a year for the rest of their life, when they're going to be earning that sort of money for 5, 6, if they're lucky, 10 years of their life. So does that clarify that?
I think so, beautifully. I hope so. I think folks will have an opportunity to call in if it was not clear. Again, this essay, Top Tips for Black Financial Empowerment, and also very closely related to the book, Buy Now, Pay Later. All of this available at the website, houseofknowledge.org.uk. I wanted to share a couple more tips before I move to a different essay. Number one, do not accumulate debt buying depreciating assets, examples, cars, electronic equipment, designer clothes, etc. Do not accumulate debt buying depreciating assets. I'll give one more. Teach your children about financial literacy. Set up a high interest savings account as soon as they are born. Encourage them to save most of their pocket money. If you can afford it, match what they have saved at the end of the year. Discuss your household budget with your children when they are old enough so that they understand that there is not an unlimited supply of money from the hole in the wall. Outstanding recommendation. And as I was reading that, I was thinking back, I don't think my parents did any aspect of that, not a one. And I suspect, sadly, that that's most likely true for a lot of Black people, African folks. I don't know, Mr. Grant, have you found that a lot of Africans, Black people, don't do that with their children?
Absolutely. I find that it's the case in many communities, although some do put more effort into teaching their children about business and money. I mean, that's kind of clear. You can kind of see different communities have a more focused effort on teaching their children about the importance of being financially solvent and viable. I mean, I certainly didn't learn anything like that when I was growing up as a child. And it's noticeable, you see, the school system doesn't teach people many of the essential things that they need to know in life. And even so-called economics. I've got a friend in the UK who's a writer who named Robin Walker, and he wrote a book, which is a wonderful book. I mean, I think one of the best books on African history, bar none, called When We Ruled. And Robin got an economics degree, and you know, he gave a lecture a couple of weeks ago in Birmingham at an event where I was also giving a talk on community economic development. And he was just breaking down for people to show them how economics degrees do not teach people the real fundamentals of economics. And as he said, I mean, if economics professors and the like knew about economics, then why is it that in general economics teachers don't earn any more money than history teachers? You'd think if they knew about economics, they would actually put these things into practice. So he was actually just showing people how these things are not taught. They're not taught in schools. Schools don't teach people the real skills they need to have for life. And unfortunately, because we've not been taught it by our parents, we then don't teach our children, so the cycle kind of continues. So part of the thing I'm trying to do is to break this cycle by giving people simple, basic tips that they can go through. And I also run a Black economics course as well, which, you know, Robin also runs. I run that in different cities in the UK, and I've also run it online as well, just to give people a micro and a macro understanding of some basic principles around economics.
Wow. Before I move on to the next one, we have a full phone line again. So a lot of folks, I hope you're enjoying the information. My co-host, she is all of 11 years old, but she is studying racism, white supremacy, and looking for solutions. Justice, if you have any questions, your line is open. Go right ahead.
Hello, Mr. Grant. How do you think you're...
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. Sorry, could you repeat that again, sorry?
Oh, I was just saying that. What were you saying?
No, I just said hello to you.
Oh, okay. How do you think your work is constructive in working against racism, white supremacy?
Okay, how is my work constructive? Well, I think, as I said, one of the things I have in all my books, I have... suggestions and tips and ideas for things that that Africans can do in order to empower us. Because my focus is on how do we empower ourselves. I mean, there's a saying: if you conquer the enemy within, the enemy without can do you no harm. So my basic premise is that, for example, if we had an analogy in a situation, an example. And to make it very simple, imagine two people walking along the road. Let's say one person is representative of white people or Europeans, the other representative of African people. Now, if the white person punches and knocks down the African person on the floor, the African person has an option. They can lay on the floor and put out their hand and say, "Why did you do that to me? Please help me up off the ground," which the person, if they hit them and knock them on the ground, why would they want to help them up? Because they obviously intended to do that, so that's where they want the person to be. The other alternative is to pick yourself up, dust yourself down, get up, stand on your own 2 feet, and be ready to protect yourself. So my focus is on the latter, which is about trying to teach our people how we can protect ourselves in all aspects of our life, whether it be around economics or whether it's around education or whether it's around relationships, as opposed to the former way of working, which I see is the kind of civil rights movement way, which is to beg and plead with the white person to stop punching us and knocking us down on the ground. So all my books are rooted in bringing theory and practice together. So, for example, when I talk about economics, you know, I created or conceived an organization, ABDF, which is doing what we talk about. We have a subsidiary company in Ghana. We've bought houses in Nottingham. So we're doing the things that I'm talking about. So for me, it's about pulling those two things together. When I talk about relationships, I'm married to an African woman for the last 15 years. We've got 2 children. So I'm doing the things that I'm talking about. So that hopefully is how I'm actually bringing constructive ideas to our people, is that I'm talking about things that I have practical experience of and where I can give people solutions that I know work. Does that answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you have offspring?
Yes, I've got two children, yes. Yeah, I've got a son who's 13 and a daughter who's 9.
I see. If so, how do you help your offspring understand and counter racism white supremacy?
Okay, well, what I believe in terms of children is there's a saying from Jamaica, which I'll try and make it intelligible for you, which says basically, force right is never good. Yeah? So when something is forced to become right too early, it's never good. That's it. Everything has its natural stage of progression and its natural way of growing. So, you know, just how we talk about now, where they're talking about these chickens that grow to maturity in 6 weeks as opposed to what the natural process would be because of the way they've been bred and all the drugs they're injected with and all the rest of it. A child has its own stage of development. So one of the things which my wife and I always conscious of doing is giving the appropriate information in terms of our children's age and level of emotional, psychological and intellectual maturity. So our main focus when the children were very young was on giving them a strong, positive African identity. So they have African names, and we've taught them about being African and about sending them to supplementary school, Saturday school. They go to African Liberation Day with us. They go to Kwanzaa with us, and about, you know, giving them a strong African identity, giving them books written by African people that give a positive representation of African people and just showing them how wonderful African people are. So that's been our focus in terms of, now obviously from time to time they have experiences and we discuss racism issues like that and we explain it to them in a way which we hope is suitable for their age. But the initial grounding for me is to give them a strong positive self-identity, because as well as needing to know what you're against, you need to know what you're for. I always believe that give the child that positive identity in terms of who they are and what they're for, and then you can teach them how to counteract things like racism within their life. Is that okay?
Yes. Do you help other non-white children understand racism, white supremacy in the UK? If so, how do you help them?
Okay, well, I do things in schools. I mean, I've been into school with my book, Sankofa, the Wise Man, and that book's, you know, been bought by many, what you refer to as non-white people. I don't do huge amounts of work outside of the African community in terms of my commitment, because my focus is on African people becoming empowered. I believe that charity begins at home, so I don't believe a weak people can help another weak group of people to be strong, or I don't believe a weak people can help a slightly stronger group of people to be strong. So we need to make African people strong if we want to bring about justice on this earth. And we also need to recognize the reality of conflicts with other group of people who are classified as non-white. So my emphasis is on getting African people to be strong, and then we can help not only ourselves but other groups of people around the world and in our localities as well. But I do go into schools. I do do work with children. I have assisted children on programs in schools, and I've done work in prisons as well with other non-white people. So in a way, that's how I see making that contribution.
Okay, thank you. That'll be all for now.
Thank you very much.
Context of white supremacy. I want to get some more solutions out and suggestions for our listeners. You have another essay outstanding. This is Top Tips for Black Parents. Some of the suggestions that I thought were really interesting, and I'd like you to kind of elaborate on these if you could. One of them is eating together. Families that eat together with the TV off, stay together. Everyone is busy. However, we need to find some time to come together and talk. Why do you feel like eating together is so important for Africans under a system of white supremacy?
Well, what I feel is that eating is a ritual as well as a way of providing nutrition for our body. And since all of us do eat, it provides a kind of natural break within the day where we can actually have what you might call an informal family conference. So we can talk about people's experience of the day, so perhaps the children's experience of the day at school, if the parents have been out to work, or if it's a Sunday. So, I was brought up traditionally that we have rice and peas and chicken. I'm a vegetarian now, but that's what I was brought up with on a Sunday. So it provides an opportunity to just touch base, because people have often now very busy lives running around doing different things. But if you can find some time where you can try and have some points in the week where you can eat together, it gives the opportunity to regroup as a family, to reconnect, to share your experiences and talk about the things you've had, the good things as well, the positive things, to laugh and joke and just have a re-energizing point during the week. So I think that too often people's lives are kind of passing side by side, and the mealtime is a convenient and good point to actually bring those lives back together in sync.
Okay. Another suggestion on the list here. We got electromagnetic downtime. African Caribbeans watch more television than any other ethnic group in the UK. The same applies for African Americans in the USA. That is astounding. Let me read that sentence one more time. African Caribbeans watch more television than any other ethnic group in the UK. The same applies for African Americans in the USA. I mean, wow, the design of racism, white supremacy. Reduce TV and other electromagnetic media consumption. Have some time when the TV, radio, MP3 player, PlayStation, etc. are switched off. Children can go to the park, play in the garden, play board games, read, etc. After a while, they will stop saying, "Mom, Dad, I'm bored." Can you kind of give us some more on why it's important to kind of unplug from all this stuff?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. There's a health reason. There's a cultural reason, sort of psychological reason. I mean, if we start with a health reason, having lots of electromagnetic radiation bombarding our bodies, which comes from computers, which unfortunately I have to spend a lot of time in front of, and also the television and other of these items. Mobile phones, again, there's been a lot of research around the impact of mobile phone usage on the brain. I mean, I think it was, I think it may have been Ericsson, one of the companies, their actual medical officer, was sacked after he highlighted the potential health impact of overusage of mobile phones. So there's a health impact in terms of what how electromagnetic radiation can disrupt the way in which our bodies function. Because obviously we have electromagnetic signals going around in our bodies. So there's a health aspect to it in terms of overexposure. The second aspect is obviously the psychological and cultural aspect in the terms of most of the stuff that we're seeing that's on the television is either directly or indirectly, overtly or implicitly anti-African and is sending out very, very negative signals. I mean, I like to say to people that I find it easier to watch a television program where there's no African people in it, because as soon as Africans in it, you find yourself bombarded with negative messages. I can quite easily cope with watching European Insanity on their programs because I kind of understand their culture. But the television is the key way of socializing and indoctrinating our children. And unfortunately, because of the way in which our family structure has broken down, you often find in the television being used as a babysitter for our children. And it's literally giving our children electromagnetic poison, I would call it, because it is socializing them to hate themselves. And if anyone spends any time just watching the coverage of African people, whether it be in news or entertainment, you'll see it's a complete diet of hatred that is presented on the television. So that's why I encourage people to encourage their children not to overconsume, and also for adults as well. And also the third point is, well, that watching things like television is very passive. It's not a hobby. It's not active. It's passive, and we need to encourage our children to use their brains, and things like reading and board games are much better for the development of the mind than things like passive activities like watching television.
Wow. I want to make sure we talk about the book, one of your books as well. And as I said, hopefully if this has been constructive, we can get you back on the program to talk about some of your other works as well. You have a different report, Sport as War Revised. There is a particular passage where you're talking about the 2006 World Cup, and you are talking about the soccer match between Ghana and the USA, and you pointed out a moment that brilliantly illustrates our victimization under the system of white supremacy. If you know which spot I'm talking about, could you share that with our audience?
I think from my memory, I can recall that's the point where Ghana were playing the United States in the World Cup, and when they finished and won the match, a player ran to the camera, and then he lifted up his Ghana shirt to reveal a T-shirt with an image of the white Jesus image, pointing to the white Jesus, you know, being responsible for the victory, and then other players crowded around pointing to the white Jesus as well. And within that essay, I kind of tried to just show how sport is far more important in terms of the symbology behind it, particularly team sports as well, even more than individual sports, although boxing got a very special place in the kind of European psyche in terms of what it symbolizes and means. And, I was kind of saying that I certainly believe that an African country would never win the Football World Cup while they have, white coaches who they bring these second-rate white coaches who failed in Europe for European club or national management. And they have this white psychology. I mean, you only have to look at the hairstyles of many of these African footballers, which they're not bleaching their hair that sort of piss blonde color, or straightening it, or whatever else they're doing it to it. You know, you can kind of see the processed mind underneath their processed hair. And I think that Ghana moment with the white Jesus being given credit for the victory just kind of symbolized so much about the current psychology of African people. And having been to Ghana as well and seen the kind of level of ultra-religiosity that's there, I mean, there were plumbing shops called the Blood of Jesus Plumbing Shop, and I kid you not, hairdressers called Jesus Died for Me, hairdressers. bumper stickers all over with, I mean, it's incredible the level of religiosity. But what also goes hand in hand with that kind of ultra-religiosity is this idea that everything that happens in life is down to a supernatural cause. And this leads to a kind of fatalism, which is not healthy for people. So that was partly what that essay was about. But that essay was trying to show people that sporting encounters are far more than just what they may seem on the surface. And I talked about Jack Johnson and the whole issue around him and what he kind of symbolized in the Caucasian psyche.
Wow. I think some of this might come up again on Sunday. Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, she'll be here, her sixth visit to the program. I think it might be relevant. I wanted to double check, Justice, if you had any questions for Mr. Grant, please go right ahead.
What suggestions can you offer to eliminate racism, white supremacy?
Okay, that's the big one, but okay, what suggestions? Well, it's not a cop-out, but what I'd say is there's so many different aspects of our lives that to cover all of them would be, we'd be here for days, obviously, which is why I write the books. But if I probably just choose a couple of areas where I can give you some simple suggestions. So relationships and economics, and the two are kind of interlinked. So relationships, one of the things I say is that we need to get married as Africans, because if we look at our culture, that was part of our process for building the units necessary to raise children. Marriage is a social institution, and its primary function is to raise strong, healthy, productive children. And we need to understand that in our way, African way, that children are meant to follow marriage. Now, some of this seems to be an area of confusion for our people, but we need to get married, and we need to use that as a basis for raising our children. We need to discard words like extended family. Africans never had a concept of extended family. They just had family. So people like grandparents, aunties, and uncles are simply considered part of your family. And certainly I know when I was growing up, you know, as a part of a cultural retention from Africa, that when I grew up, I had lots of people I called auntie and uncle who were not biologically related to me. So we can find strength there within our culture that can help us in terms of family composition. We need to see relationships and marriage as not just being about romantic love, but we need to understand that a relationship has a political dimension to it. So the family is the basic building block of our society and is, if you will, the first unit of defense and offense against any assault we receive from any other group. So the family becomes a basic economic unit. It becomes a basic socialization unit, basic cultural unit, the way in which we transmit ideas and values. So when you pick a mate, the basis of picking a mate has to be more than do they look good and make me feel, you know, kind of good. If I put that for an 11-year-old, I'm sure you know what I mean. It has to be a much, much broader criteria. You know, so for example, when I met my wife, I took her to meet my parents. Now, not overtly to say, would you approve of her, but yes, to seek their approval. You know, even though I was a big man, but I took her to meet my parents, my older brother, my younger sister, to see what they thought about her. You know, and similarly, my brother did the same with his wife. So they're just some basic ideas about starting to build and understand the importance of family as a foundation block for building the nation. Is that a beginning answer?
Yes. How do white people treat non-white people in the UK?
Well, obviously, that's a big, broad question because there's millions and millions of white people in the UK. And what I would say in the UK and from what I know of the US, I'd say that racial hostility is a lot less overt in the UK than it is in the US. And that's partly, again, due to population size, that there aren't so many Africans and there aren't so many other non-white people in the UK. I mean, the population is growing, and in places where you find it growing, you find sort of some increased hostility. But people, you know, that the way in which this concept that people call racism, in the UK, what they're trying to do is make you think that racism is about people calling you names. So do they call you the N-word and things like that? So they're trying to convince people that if nobody calls you a name, there's no racism in the society. But as you know, I'm sure, it's far more subtle than that. So what you find is that the social outcomes for African people are very bad, similarly, just as they are for Africans in the US. But on a surface, superficial level, there isn't huge overt hostility towards African people as an individual. So you won't find, you know, people calling you lots of names and being overtly saying you can't go here or you can't go there. But what you find is, you know, that the rate of imprisonment of African people is very, very high, proportionately higher than for Africans in the US. You know, when you look at our proportion of the prison population in the UK, unemployment levels are very, very high. Being sectioned or locked up in the mental health system where they lock you up against your will, again, is very, very high. So all the kind of negative indicators for African people are very, very bad, as they are in the US, but it's much more, I'd say, it's much more subtle than it is in the US. Was that clear to you?
Yes. What do you do around white people that practice racism and white supremacy?
What do we do around them? Just repeat the question, please.
What do you do around white people that practice racism and white supremacy?
It's a difficult question because it's very broad again, but what I would say is that almost all, and I think you've had Tim Wise on before, almost all white people participate in the system, not necessarily consciously, because it is part of their culture. And, you know, I mean, as I said, there's probably about six different explanations of what this thing is that people call white supremacy, you know, and Marin Barani talks about the Asili, or the cultural seed, of Europeans, and give it in the book Yorugu. So because it's part of their culture, in terms of what do you do around them? I mean, I take a protective stance. I mean, what I do is I'm consciously aware of my environment, who I'm around, and whether that individual or individuals may or may not have be hostile to me. So you deal with people's overt behavior, what you can see they're doing on an overt way, but you also try to pick up more subtle cues from people. And you also have to remember as well, there are many Africans who hate being African, so they can be, you know, a danger to you or at least against you as well. And I sometimes get attacked by Africans for the things that I write. You know, for example, Africans who have European Caucasian partners may not like some of the things that I like, and then they say I'm a racist and things like that. So I have a strategy where I'm working towards empowering African people. When I'm around Caucasians or white people, I'm conscious of what I'm trying to achieve through that interaction. And in this British society, we said, with us being such a small minority, I'm interacting with them, you know, quite frequently. I'm not looking to form any friendships. I'm looking to do things that are going to be beneficial to me, and that's the way in which I operate. So I think just to be consciously aware of your environment, whoever you're around, and don't make assumptions that because somebody looks like you, they share the same value system, because they don't. That's not necessarily the case.
What do you mean when you say culture?
Oh, what do you mean when you say culture? Culture is the values, the beliefs, the rituals, the worldview, the way you understand why we're here, the way you understand what the nature of the universe is, all those ideas, beliefs, practices which inform the way you live your life. So it's culture that determines the way you view relationships between men and women, the way you view the nature of the Creator. It's a fabric that really lays out the way people live and what they see as important and the things they see as not important.
Okay, that'll be all for now.
Thank you.
Mr. Grant, are you familiar with Tim Wise?
Tim Wise, I've watched probably two or three of his lectures on the internet. So I've not read any of his books, but I've watched extensively. I've watched probably at least, over an hour at a time, so I've watched extensively his lectures. So I'm familiar with him.
Okay. What's your impression of him?
My impression is he's saying what many Africans have said a long time before, but he gets more publicity for it because he's white.
Yeah,
ironically enough, I mean, his kind of rise to fame is actually, in a way, the proof of what he's saying.
Exactly. And he knows that. He's very aware of that.
You see the particular deference that many of the Africans in his audiences have for him, because he's not actually saying anything different other Africans haven't, but because it comes from his mouth. I mean, the clearest example I can give is somebody said once there was a church congregation and their minister, who's an African, was trying to convince them to take down the white Jesus and either have a non kind of racial image or have an African image. And there were particularly some of the elders were resistant to it. And then a white minister came in and said the same thing. And then they all were happy to take it down.
Oh my gosh, man. I'm having to laugh to keep from crying. Like, wow. That is, that's a really devastating illustration of white supremacy. And that is exactly why the context of white supremacy started with white people. We've done over 200 programs. Tim Wise has been on this show 6 times. I started with white people so that I have a firm foundation of white people saying, yes, there is racism, white supremacy. Such a system does exist. And no, Mr. Grant is not crazy. So that non-white people would be more comfortable receiving this information. Wow, that is incredible. And I'm trying to put Tim Wise out of business, make sure everybody knows that. Tim Wise is an admitted racist, and he referenced Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's work as pseudoscientific bullshit. We discussed that on this program. You can go back and check the archives, anybody listening. Tim Wise, out of business as soon as possible. He is an admitted racist. The book, transitioning. The book, Niggers, Negroes, Black People, and Africans. What is the purpose of this book, and especially why the title?
Yeah, the title got me in some hot water, so it's, but strangely enough, it's my best-selling book, so it is an interesting kind of paradox. The title, I mean, the one thing I regret is actually just the page layout design, but having niggers at the top, that's the only thing I regret in terms of that. But in terms of the title, the substance of the book is about identity. It's also about organizing and how identity informs the way in which groups of people organize themselves and their capacity to organize effectively. The reason I used those words was because we sometimes come to view words as being, thinking that language that we use is non-political or is neutral. So, for example, the word black has become the most commonly used word to describe people like myself, yourself. So what's the young sister's name? Justice. Justice and many other people who look like us. And so people have come to assume, for example, that the word black is a neutral term. But, of course, at one stage, the term colored in places like the United States and Caribbean was the kind of standard word to use. And obviously there was the word Negro, because Marcus Masai Garvey had the Universal Negro Improvement Association. He also subtitled his organization the African Communities League, but he knew that African wouldn't be so well accepted, so he used Negro because that was the most common popular phrase. And now, of course, is what we have this, what I call neo-slave culture that's grown up, where particularly young Africans are calling themselves niggers, but also not so young Africans. And then they think they're empowering themselves by changing the spelling to N-I-G-G-A-Z or something like that. And we have the term Africans as well. So what I was trying to show people was that the language we use tells us about ourselves and our worldview. It's not just neutral. None of those terms are neutral. They all have a history and a significance. And part of what I was doing was trying to get people to think about how they think about themselves and what that means about their own worldview. And then in other parts of the book, I'm looking at, I give a kind of a plantation kind of reference for what, how I see those kind of terms relate to the psychology of how Africans may have operated in different ways on the, in the kind of plantation setting, and then moved it to what you might call the current contemporary plantation, in terms of how we live in a kind of colonized society, whether we're in the majority or whether we're in the minority, we're still in many ways colonized.
For folks who are listening in, if this is your first time, I know a lot of people in the States listening, this might be your first time getting some exposure to Mr. Paul Ifeoma Grant. This man, this book, you have a portion of the book, Behavioral and Psychological Characteristics of African Men. And you have a chart here, and I'm looking at the nigger chart, and you lay out a set of characteristics, behavior patterns that you observe in this group. And I'll just read a few if you could kind of expound. The behavioral psychological characteristics, this is the physical and imaginative world, generally confined to a few square miles of ghetto, cannot see beyond this turf. Participates in black-on-black violence. Engages in compensatory masculinity and views breeding many women as a mark of his manhood. Views children as trophies. What do you mean when you say compensatory masculinity?
Well, that was really drawing on the work of Amos Wilson, which I'm sure you're very familiar with his work. And what that was saying was that males are brought up with an idea as to what they think a man is and a man should do. Now, if a group of males are blocked from achieving those ends, those goals, they will seek alternative ways in which to demonstrate that they have achieved full masculine man status. So normally what would happen is that when women are seeking a partner, a husband, they normally choose what that people would describe as the most socially adaptive male. Now you might, some people call it alpha male or whatever. Normally a male who's been able to demonstrate that they can in effect take care of them. And I don't mean that in a kind of patronizing or demeaning way. What I mean by that is that women still have the children. So when a woman is pregnant, she's in some senses more physically vulnerable than she is. And also in another sense, the kind of nesting instinct comes in, and she would like to not have to, you know, work 40 hours a week and, you know, do everything. She'd like to have a partner, a husband, who can to some extent take care of the finances, the economics, so she can at least have a break to produce children. And that goes for whether you're talking about a kind of highly industrialized society to a, you know, to societies that are more subsistence. So women generally look for, certainly in the past, have looked for men not so much on the basis of looks, you know, has he got a six pack or, you know, is he buff or whatever term is used now. They look at men, does he have resources? Is he able to solve problems? Can he, you know, look after himself and look after myself? Is he, you know, is he responsible? Now, when men get into a situation where they become conquered, as African men have been conquered in that, and African people are conquered, then some of the parameters for a male achievement become blocked off, particularly some of the economic parameters. So what then starts to happen is you start to get a distorted view of what it means to be a man, both in terms of how men view themselves and operate, and also how females view potential partners. So then women may start to select men on more trivial categorizational characteristics, like, for example, physical characteristics, as opposed to more substantive criteria. And men might start to choose actions or results, for example, like producing lots of children, as being a means of showing that I'm a fully functional man, as being able, as opposed to being able to, for example, set up their own company and employ people, or get married and have a lesser number of children, but who you actually take care of on a day-to-day basis. So this is what we mean by compensating masculinity. It's to compensate for the fact that we've been conquered, yet we still have this desire to show that we're functioning as full-blown men. Does that make sense?
Crystal clear, sir. Crystal clear. Again, I guess, real privilege to have him on the program, live from the United Kingdom. Paul, if I only grant his website, houseofknowledge.org.uk. Again, houseofknowledge.org.uk. Wow. I think another way African males, black males, compensate for being conquered is the trophy white woman. You have a portion of the book, part three, Mind Matters. Portion is called The Politics, Psychology, and Sociology of Miscegenation. You write, I should make it clear that it is not about whether two people with significantly differing levels of skin melanin or any other physical, biological characteristics can fall in love. It is not about any particular individual or designed to hurt people's feelings. It is about the politics, psychology, and sociology of miscegenation, with a particular emphasis on the politics. It is about understanding how a group of people with power who call themselves white use that power to control the sexual relationships of another less powerful group of people who they call black. It is about power and the wielding of power in aid of white supremacy. Wow. Can you kind of deconstruct what you're saying here, sir?
Okay. One of the things I was kind of interested in was I listened to various debates and discussions, and people would often say things like, make wide generalizations on the subject of miscegenation or mixed relationships, mixed racial relationships, or interracial sexual relationships, and say things like, oh, white people don't want to have sexual relationships with black people because black people will breed them out and stuff like that. And I was looking at the situation in the UK and thought, well, the UK doesn't really reflect what some people are saying. I mean, a lot of people say this from the kind of US context, because in the UK, I mean, there's very little taboo at all about being involved in mixed relations. In fact, for Africans, it's seen as the norm for many Africans, and certainly for young Africans, the majority are now involved. Certainly, African Caribbeans, the majority are involved in mixed relationships, and certainly when you look at when you get to the world of work, you actually see that Caucasians actually seem to feel more comfortable with Africans who have white partners. So I was trying to say, okay, what's really going on across the scene? What I decided to do in this chapter was to look at different places around the world which have got different relative ratios of Africans and Europeans, and then look at the behavior of Caucasians in terms of how they respond to this whole issue about sexual relationships. So I took Australia, Britain, United Kingdom, the USA, South Africa, and Brazil. And I looked at those five settings and examined what was underpinning the nature of whether these relationships were seen as more or less acceptable, more or less taboo or stigma attached to them. And what I basically saw from my analysis that it was really about the level of the African population. And if the African population was very high, as in, for example, South Africa, or in some of the states in the United States, particularly many of the southern states, what Caucasians had a tendency to do was to create, one, physical separation through residential segregation. So in in South Africa, they called it apartheid. In the United States, obviously, you have your so-called ghettos, and you obviously have your Jim Crow system, which is a system of apartheid. You go to a place like Brazil, they have the favelas, which is where they create the physical separation. They obviously create economic barriers as well, because the economics obviously determines as well where you can live. So if you keep the African population poor, they're not going to be able to move into the areas where the more affluent European population lives. And then as you go to populations with much smaller African population, like in the UK, you find there's been no residential segregation through law or by law, and Africans have been able to intermingle much more freely with white people. So we could quite clearly see that the kind of level of hostility and the level of restriction was quite clearly linked to the population ratio and the ability of Africans to actually change the genetic makeup of the white population. Now, I did, when you kind of add on to that sort of that whole scenario which I laid out there, when we actually kind of probed somewhere like Australia, you see that Europeans actually had an overt debate about what was the best process by which they should control the black Aboriginal population. So in the 19th century, they had two basic discussions. One was around separation, and the other one was around assimilation. So in the end, although they created these so-called kind of reservations or concentration camps for those Aboriginals who didn't want to assimilate, what they actually chose to do was to go down the assimilation path. So they had a white Australia policy, both not only in terms of immigration into Australia, but they systematically kidnapped children, Aboriginal children, put them in these homes, which again are just like another fancy way of a prison, and socialized them to marry whites, with the idea being that in three generations they could eliminate any visual indicator that they had any black ancestry. And there's a film called I think Rabbit Proof Fence, which actually documents and tells you in dramatic form this whole process that they had in Australia, which is basically about breeding out the Aboriginal population, because obviously that population is very small and could be easily absorbed by the white population. So that's what this chapter sets out to do. It gives people who may not be familiar with places like Brazil, it gives you some insight into the whole process of trying to eliminate African population groups, which was a clear policy after the end of enslavement in Brazil in 1888, where they had a policy of encouraging massive white migration from various parts of Europe and the world to increase what they called improve the racial stock of Brazil, and give those people jobs, and to leave the Africans who'd been supposedly freed from slavery to basically live in misery and to starve.
Wow. You said that when you get into the workplace, white people are more comfortable with Africans who are sexually paired with a white person. Is that accurate? You did say that, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's been my, I mean, there are still white people in the UK who obviously are very hostile to these kind of relationships. But generally, my experience has been that when you look at how white people respond to Africans, particularly actually when people are climbing the ladder, people are seen as, you know, moving up, they seem to be more comfortable with black people who've got a white partner. And simply because I think they see those people as being more psychologically and culturally like them, more amenable
wow.
to the things that they want. So, I mean, I've seen organizations where every single one of the black senior managers in the organization has a white partner. And for example, there was quite recently, there was there was interviews of about five people, all editors of either black magazines or black newspapers, and all of them had white partners.
Wow.
The one was called Pride. ironically enough. So that's what I've generally found, that white people are more comfortable with black people who have white partners, because they see those people as being largely culturally assimilated.
Wow. That is astonishing. Herman Oosley, would he qualify as well?
I'm not sure who he's who he's doing his thing with at the moment. There's a successor to him called Trevor Phillips.
Yes.
Who is the who's the head of the what do they call it? It used to be the Racial Equality Commission for Racial Equality.
Right.
It's now the Human Rights Commission. And of course, I mean he's a classic Uncle Tom. And I think he had an Asian partner before. Now he's got a white partner, and he's a classic assimilationist, dreaming of a coffee-coloured future.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
But I mean, almost every single African of any kind of prominence, I think 90% of them have white partners in the UK. TV presenters. I mean, in terms of, for example, footballers, I can't think of a single black footballer in the UK who's actually born in the UK who has a black partner in the top league. And I can't even think of any in the lower leagues, actually. The only ones I can think of who play in the top league who have a black partner weren't born in the UK, like Didier Drogba from Ivory Coast, that come from Africa or other places. None of them who are born in the UK that I can think of have a black partner. Not one.
Wow. Why, it's not just Tiger Woods here. See that? See that? Like, wow. Context of white supremacy, our guest again, Paul Ifeomi Grant. This chapter, and I think this will tell a lot about the why this behavior occurs. This chapter, the title again, or section, The Politics, Psychology, and Sociology of Miscegenation, it is a subset of a portion of the book titled Mind Matters. Why would sexual intercourse between Africans and white people be in a section titled Mind Matters?
Because the sex act is controlled by the mind. Sexual desire comes from the mind. It doesn't come from the sexual organs. It's the mind that actually is trained and developed and actually creates sexual desire. And, you know, and we're socialized this through from a very early stage in our childhood, we socialized into what's seen as acceptable or unacceptable forms of sexual activity. So, for example, you know, the rise of homosexuality being considered to be normal. That's about socialization and culture and people being trained to think in a particular way. So the whole idea of sex and sexual desire comes from the mind, first of all. It doesn't come from the body. And obviously, sexual relationships are about the most fundamental thing that people do, because it's how we produce life and reproduce our species. So there's nothing more fundamental than sexual relationships.
Wow. I want to see if Justice has some more questions, but I just want to read this to kind of put a nice cherry on this. I feel this is critically important. I think Chancellor Williams talks about how white people have used sexual intercourse to conquer Africans for years. I feel it is critically important that Africans, all non-white people, do not engage in sexual intercourse with white people. It has a just incredibly destructive impact on the African mind, the non-white mind, and our ability to replace white supremacy with justice immediately. In the same chapter, Mr. Paul Ifeomi Grant writes that white U.S. policymakers have cottoned onto the fact that already endangered African families' capability to produce African social warriors against white supremacy can be further weakened by the increase in family units where one parent has no cultural or biological reason to fight white supremacy. He goes on to say, in chess, just as in life, the white pieces are the offensive pieces, and the black pieces must work together to coordinate a defense and finally a telling counterattack. If the African king does not work in concert with the African queen because he is too busy wondering what is under the white queen's skirt, the black side will be defeated. justice. Do you have any questions for Mr. Grant? Justice, are you there? If you're there, we can't hear you.
I took a look at your website, and I'm going to kind of change the topic a little bit, but there I go. What views of Malcolm X do you think should be repeated most often?
What of Malcolm X? What, repeat the question. I heard a bit about Malcolm X should be repeated most often. Was it his view or quote?
What views of Malcolm X do you think should be repeated most often?
Okay, what views of Malcolm X? I would say probably by any means necessary, and of all subjects, history is the best place to reward our studies.
What do you mean when you say Pan-Africanism, and what is the difference between continentalist Pan-Africanism and Black Power Pan-Africanism?
Wow, that's a great question. That's a an interesting question. Yeah, Pan-Africanism. Pan-Africanism, as it was first created, and I give a little bit of history. I mean, people like Henry Sylvester Williams is from Trinidad. Actually, a lot of the founding fathers, and it was mainly males, not the founding fathers of Pan-Africanism, were actually from the Caribbean. People like Henry Sylvester Williams, Blyden, and others, when they talked about Pan-Africanism, they were talking about the unity of African people, recognizing Africa to be our motherland. What happened was, unfortunately, around 1945, and I have great admiration for Kwame Nkrumah, great admiration for him, but he was one of the people who started to create this new version of Pan-Africanism, which started to focus on everybody who lives on Africa, and suggesting that we should have this unified Africa where people who are Arabs, effectively, and who make it clear that they're Arabs, and who have allegiance to other Arabs, we're supposed to, and have enslaved African people for well over 1,000 years, we're supposed to suddenly switch our attention and now have this rainbow coalition of everyone who lives on the African continent. So Black Power Pan-Africanism focuses on black people as the basis and says that it's the people that's most important in Pan-Africanism, not just the landmass. To my view, continentalist Pan-Africanism says that it's the landmass that's most important rather than the people, because most of the countries in the north of Africa, they call themselves the Arab Republic of. They're part of the Arab League, even though some of them, like Sudan, have actually got Africans who don't want to be black, so want to call themselves Arabs. Now, I've always been taught that a man or woman can't serve two masters. They're not in Arabia, but they are full of Arab people, and they make it clear by being part of the Arab League where their loyalty lies. So Black Power Pan-Africanism is what Marcus Garvey talked about. He talked about unifying the 400 million Negroes in the world. So he was quite clear about what he was saying. So I'm about Black Power. I'm about African people uniting. I'm not about pretending that before Europeans came into Africa, that Africans and Arabs were living in wonderful harmony, because Arabs were enslaving Africans. And in fact, the European intervention in the sort of 15th century and onwards, in many places, actually interrupted the Arab enslavement of Africans. And there's many books. If I can find one, I've got a very good one, but I'll try and find a reference if I can for a book that people could go and read on the subject. And even today, in Mauritania, you see Africans are being enslaved by Arabs. If you go into Sudan, you see the same thing happening. And you find Africans still being sold into slavery right here and now today as we talk. And for some reason, the continentalists want to brush over this and ignore this. And I'm not sure if it's because Kwame Nkrumah had an Arab wife. Unfortunately, Sheikh Anta Diop, he wrote a brilliant book called The Unity of Black Africa. I'm trying to remember the full title, but it's an excellent book which is talking about how Africa could unite, but then he makes the same issue of trying to brush over the history of Arabs and Africans in Africa. Because you have to remember that Arabs control nearly 40% of the landmass of Africa, and you have to ask yourself, how did that happen? So that's the basic fundamental difference in terms of what you might call black power pan-Africanism, which is what a term that the Nigerian scholar Chinwezu uses, and what he calls continentalist pan-Africanists, who don't seem to want to address the Arab question.
You did answer my question.
Is that clear?
Yes, you did answer my question. How can the system of racism, white supremacy be stopped?
I think that's probably similar to a question that you asked earlier, but to give a kind of short, relatively short answer, Frederick Douglass, who was actually an assimilationist, but also did many good things for our people, said the only argument that satisfies man is power. And if you want definitions of power, Professor Wade Noble says, power is the ability to define reality and have other people respond to your definition as if it were their own. And another simple definition is, power is the ability to cause or prevent change. So the way in which it will be stopped is when African people get enough power in order to be able to stop it. So when we can defend ourselves physically, so militarily, so when we have the military means, for example, to stop Europeans physically invading our lands, and we see they have still a very strong desire to invade other people's countries and kill them, particularly if they consider them to be non-white. When we have the economic means to protect ourselves and to provide for our needs, you know, for example, there's not an African country that can refine petroleum. And when we have the cultural integrity that allows us to see being black, being African, as the most important part of our identity, although people can still follow whatever religions they want, but, you know, we need to understand that that has to come first in terms of organizing ourselves as a group. When we have those things in place, then we will be able to stop the system that you're referring to.
Okay, that'll be all for now.
Thank you.
We have quite a few folks that called in. Mr. Grant, are you okay with some calls?
Yeah, that would be great. It would be good to hear from them.
Okay. Let's see. Person who called in, I think this is 818. 818, did you have a question for Mr. Grant?
Not at this time.
Okay. Blocked number, different person calling from a blocked number. Did you have a question for Mr. Grant?
Hello?
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Okay. Good morning. Mr. Grant, out there in the UK, is it illegal for certain age groups to have cell phones?
Is it illegal for them to have cell phones?
Yeah, certain age, like under, under a certain age. I just was wondering.
No. There's no age limit on having a cell phone or what we call mobiles here. But yeah, no age.
Oh, okay. I know in some European countries it is illegal for, you know, like if you're under 16 to have a cell phone. I was wondering if it was the same out there in where you are.
No, you see 8, 9, 10-year-olds with cell phones here.
Oh, sad. Anyway, I wanted to ask you about we have, like, these child labor laws, and I was doing some research, and I found out that a lot of the, very successful business people, they started working at a young age. Do you think that young people should be, start working at an early age so they can get that business acumen?
I think that young people should start working in the sense of having household tasks, what you call chores. So that, you know, that should be something that should be built in, whether it's basic things around, because it's about building in that discipline to know that you have to make a contribution to the household, you know, which is appropriate to your age and size. And then I often see, you know, in some shops that I've been into where you see a child in the family will be sitting behind the till taking money and learning again about how money works and learning that the correct relationship for them is to take other people's money and not give it to them. So I think definitely, I don't mean 40 hours a week because obviously they've got their education, but I think work and some structured work is definitely good for young people, particularly where it teaches them entrepreneurialism, where it teaches them about being creative and teaches them how to handle money and finance. So I think that's definitely a good idea. It doesn't necessarily have to be a formal job, although, of course, children do things like paper rounds and things like that, which, again, you know, instills discipline in terms of waking up in the morning and doing a job. But I think certainly in terms of promoting entrepreneurialism, because one of the things I think we need to do is to move our people away from the sort of job mentality much more towards business mentality. Does that answer your point?
I mean, I was wondering what you thought about it. You know, I was, like I said, I was doing research, and, you know, Warren Buffett, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, a lot of these people, what I found out is that, you know, the so-called elite, or, you know, they encourage their children to have, you know, cash businesses, whether it be lemonade stands, selling newspaper,
yeah,
fish or whatever. They encourage that at a young age, and I just was wondering if you had, you know, what your thoughts were on that. But thanks.
Well, I think this is an excellent idea. I mean, it could be simple things like washing cars, and all those kind of things. I mean, I remember reading, I think it was one of the Rockefellers, where his children had to keep a financial ledger of all the money they got in during the course of a year, you know, gifts and other forms of money that they got in, and they had to produce a ledger. So I think having that awareness of business and being creative and entrepreneurial, I think is, definitely is a good idea, and we should encourage our children. It's far better for them than, you know, just sitting around playing games all the while, or just on these PlayStations, all the rest of it, you know, or spending all their time playing basketball, whatever it may be.
Excellent question. Thank you, 919. 909, sorry. 818, do you have a question? 818, your line is open.
Yes, I did have another question. Greetings, Mr. Grant. I have a question for you. You spoke about the high rate of sexual relationships between black people and white people or other non-black people in the UK, and I've heard this from quite a few other people there as well, other black people. I was wondering, have you observed any hostility or antagonism between, let's say, black females who are in sexual relationships with white men and black men who are in sexual relationships with white women? Like, do you see an animosity between those two, the black male and female, in that, who are both engaging in those relationships?
So let me clarify. So you're saying between, hostility between black women in relationship with white men and black men in relationship with white women?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Sometimes I mean, maybe not quite so common now, but certainly I've encountered is sometimes this, some black men have a very hypocritical stance where they have always engaged in relationship with white women, yet, for example, they'll be hostile if their sister even starts to hint that she might be starting looking at white men as a mate. So they think it's okay for them, but not, for example, for, you know, other black women to do the same thing. So I haven't seen that more coming from some black men. But generally, any hostility tends to be between, for example, black people who don't agree with it, who have black partners or want black partners, in terms of how they view black people who won't date other black people.
Thank you. Thank you, 818, ebonynewschannel.blogspot.com. We actually have a caller from your area of the world, Mr. Grant, Skydrifter. If you have a question for Mr. Grant, you should be available. Skydrifter, did you have a question? not able to hear you, sir. Not able to hear you. Not sure if your mic is working. If you want to. Okay. I'm going to take another caller. Hopefully you can get your mic corrected, and I'll come back to you, Scott Drifter. Person who called in. Oh, thank you for being patient. She was like on, or this person was on the line almost from the very beginning of the show with a question. 3413, did you have a question?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Right on. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening. Last four digits, 7012, 7012. Did you have a question?
No question at this moment, but thank you for the show. Thank you, brother, for the information.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening. I'm not sure. ASA, I'm not sure about the pronunciation here. It looks like Rondo, maybe. Did you have a question, or are you just listening?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes. What are your thoughts of the AU and in general about, because we do have homelands, and people thinking of actually re-immigrating back in their homelands and trying to build them up. Hello?
I'm listening. So it's about what I think of the AU and also about repatriation?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. And you've probably gathered to my answer around the issue around continentalist Pan-Africanism and Black Power Pan-Africanism. I'm not a particular fan of the African Union. I think people like Gaddafi are using it as a Trojan horse to push his own Pan-Arabism. If I can just, I want to see if I can actually, while we're speaking, I'll try and just find one of his latest quotes, because unfortunately, many of the died-in-the-wall continentalists just will not have a word said against Mr. President Gaddafi, and believe that somehow he's a friend of Africa now. He wants to be the president of the first president of a united Africa. I don't believe that the AU is doing anything in particular for African people. It's been completely silent on what's been going on in Mauritania. It's done nothing to stop the onslaught in Sudan. So I'm not a particular great fan of it. Now, in terms of repatriation, I am a great fan of repatriation. Let me see if I can just... I just want to find you this... here we go. Find you this about Colonel Gaddafi, who's one of the big players in continentalist Pan-Africanism. Let me see if this will open. This is taken from the BBC website. I think it was 31st of August this year. Yeah, 31st of August. The headline is, Gaddafi wants EU cash to stop African migrants. Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi says the EU should pay Libya at least 5 billion euros, 4 billion pounds, or $6.3 billion a year to stop illegal African immigration and avoid a black Europe. Speaking on a visit to Italy, Colonel Gaddafi said Europe could turn into Africa as there are millions of Africans who want to come in. And then he goes down to say, he was speaking at a ceremony in Rome late on Monday, standing next to Italy's Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi. He says, we don't know what will happen, what will be the reaction of the white and Christian Europeans faced with this influx of starving and ignorant Africans, Colonel Gaddafi said. We don't know if Europe will remain an advancing united continent or if it will be destroyed as happened with the barbarian invasions. So that's just one of his little... discussions recently, but yeah, I'm not a great fan of the AU. And if you go to my website and you go on Chinwezu Corner, there's many essays there written by the Nigerian scholar Chinwezu, and I think if you read those, he gives an excellent excellent.
But what about the concept itself? What about the concept itself? Not the influx or the influence of Arabism on it, but the concept of a united Africa, and as you said, repatriation of Africans back to Africa.
I don't see the two things as being necessarily one being essential for the other. You don't have to have a united whole continent of Africa in order to have repatriation of Africans. I mean, at the moment you've got 53 or 54 mainly very weak states. You could join them all together and have one very weak, enormous state. Because putting weakness together doesn't necessarily create strength. Also, there is no actual logical argument that's been created that says that you need to have the whole 12.5 million square miles united in order to produce a black superpower. You know, you could fit the United States, Western Europe, and Australia, India, many other countries, all within Africa. So, for example, ECOWAS, the West African Union, Economic Union, that territory itself is easily large enough to be a superpower on the world stage. You know, so you don't need to have the whole continent together in order to have black power. What we need to be working for is the unity of black people around the world. So whether they be the United States, Europe, Caribbean, with others in Africa. And there are already, when I went to Ghana, one of the things I was looking at was around repatriation land. There are chiefs giving repatriation land. I know people in Ghana who've repatriated from the Caribbean, from the UK, from the USA. There's been some repatriations, land given in Uganda. One of the things that people are fighting for in Ghana, some of the people I know, is to get citizenship. So what we need is those African countries that are controlled by African people to grant us citizenship in those countries. And that will speed the process of repatriation. Because at the moment, we're treated just the same as somebody coming from Denmark who wants to move into, say, Ghana or wherever it may be. So I think repatriation is a must and is positive. Not everyone's going to go, but I think building that link and creating what you might call a global clan or tribe that's interconnected is absolutely vital. And I think there's many things that some of those African governments could do to facilitate that would be beneficial to them. And there's things that we could do from our end towards making that happen. And that's one of the reasons why our company, ABDF, why we have made links initially in Ghana, and we want to spread to other countries as well. So definitely repatriation, thumbs up. AU, not convinced.
Thank you for the caller. I want to double check. Sky Drifter, did you have a question? Are you okay? All right. So he's good. Justice, did you have any questions you wanted to ask?
I don't have any questions at this moment. Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to, before the end of the broadcast, I wanted to look at your essay, because this comes up a lot on the program about black male and black female relationships. You also have an essay, Top Tips for Black Love. I thought this was really interesting. If you could kind of share some thoughts on this, this would be great. One of your suggestions, you asked rhetorically, what is your relationship model? How did you come to your ideas of what a good relationship is? Are there good black relationships that you have experience of that you are seeking to emulate? Quite profound, I thought. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, one of my thoughts and ideas and beliefs is that our people are in large degree, in large numbers, are suffering from deep alienation. Alienation from self, and hence alienation from ourselves as a group and other members of the group. And I think this kind of profound and deep alienation is played out very poignantly in the kind of widespread poor relationships which we see, you know, particularly in places like the USA and the UK, between African men and women. So I'm just trying to look in my book to actually find the actual section. where we had the top tips. But so the idea about the relationship was actually trying to get people to think about relationships in the broader front, because I think the way in which they're socialized in this kind of European dominated culture is around this concept of romantic love. And the idea of romantic love was only developed around 300 years ago in Europe. And it was developed in the royal courts of Europe. That's where you get the term courting from. It was people who had time on their hand, poets and all these other aristocracy, and they developed all these protocols and rituals about and ideas about romantic love. So this whole concept, you know, the knight in shining armor and this man's going to come and sweep you off your feet and all the rest of it, are not necessarily rooted in our cultural history, and particularly at this time when we're in the situation we are as people have been conquered. Also, I was concerned by the fact that many of our people seem to get their notions of relationships from people who don't seem to have any functional relationships themselves. Now, for example, people listening to ideas spouted by people like, say, Oprah Winfrey, who is widely reputed as a lesbian, and if she's never had a functional relationship with an African man, as far as I'm aware, in her life. Yet, sisters listening to people like this to give them ideas as to how to have effective relationships with African men seems to be completely bizarre. And men also with distorted ideas as to what they should expect from a woman in a relationship. So the whole thing was to get people to go back to kind of base and say, the best people to give me good ideas about relationships are people who've been able to create effective relationships themselves. We need to look at our culture. We need to look at what is the purpose of a relationship. We need to look at how are we trying to form lifelong partnerships which are meant to help to build the strength of our group as well as to satisfy us as an individual. So we have to stop being so individualistic. We also need to understand that a relationship, particularly a marriage, is a union of two families, not just of two individuals. So you have to think about what is the family that I'm marrying into and look at that whole concept, because again, if you look in African culture, what would often be the maternal aunt, one of the senior maternal aunts, who would do a check on the family of the other person. So if she was the maternal aunt of the prospective groom, then she would check out the family of the bride and from the other side as well, to make sure that this person comes from a suitable family. So it was about going much more deeply into why people choose to go into relationships and what they're looking for. And in my book, Blue Skies for Africans, I have a whole section about, a whole chapter about relationships. And I try to give, which is called What Have You Witnessed? Love Ships or Survival Ships? Where I try to give people some ideas about how they can actually begin to have more productive relationships and how they can go into relationships with a more positive mindset and hopefully get something out of it that's going to be long-standing and good for them. And I just think at the moment we've got some very bizarre ideas about how you actually pick a partner.
Wow. I want to double check just to make sure I didn't miss anybody. Michael, did you have a question or are you just listening? Okay, so he's just listening. The website, again, houseofknowledge.org.uk. One more time, houseofknowledge.org.uk. Real privilege to have you on the program, sir. I don't know, it might have been a waste of your time, but I found it extremely constructive, thoroughly appreciated it. And if you'd be willing, we would love to have you back on the program to look at some of your other books and just share as much as you would like, sir.
That would be, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I hope everyone who wanted to call in got to call in, and I'm really pretty impressed. So, yeah, I'd love to come back on. I'd be very happy to do that.
Outstanding. If you would like to share anything, I've promoted the website, but if anything that you would like to let folks know, books or anything they should be looking out for, please feel free.
Yeah, just very briefly, if they do want to purchase my books or CD, they can get them on my website. They can also get some of my books from Brother Natty, African World Books in Baltimore. If you just do probably a search for African World Books, Brother Natty stocks some of my books. He's my US distributor. And if they want to email me, they can email me at ifayomi, I-F-A-Y-O-M-I, at ntlworld.com, ifayomi at ntlworld.com.
Outstanding. Like I said, impressive work. I'm really glad we were able to get you on the program. Thank you again, Roz43, for the suggestion. Outstanding work, and I'm looking forward to having you on the program again real soon, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on the cast.
Thank you so much, sir. We'll be in touch soon.
Thank you very much, and you will have a good weekend.
Thank you. Take care, sir. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Context of white supremacy. I have a few of the folks online. If you want to share views, I do want to take a moment to promote Mr. Williams' commercial, Counter Racism Radio Network, and we'll be right back. Context of white supremacy.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? At counterracism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Context of white supremacy, end of summer blackout. We'll be back on Sunday. Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing makes her sixth visit to the cows this Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central, and 3 p.m. Pacific. I guess for the London folks, that would be 11 p.m. Sunday, September 5th, Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, visit number 6. Justice, did you have any thoughts you'd like to share about what you heard today?
Yes. It was constructive, and I did hear him say that he talks to kids. And, yeah, I thought that was interesting.
I think he has a book that's written for kids that's about racism, too. It's called Sankofa and the Wise Man, I believe. I'll look at it so that I have the correct title.
Okay.
Sankofa and His Amazing Friend. I'm sorry, that's it. It does have Sankofa the Wise Man on the front of the book. That was what I was reading. I think it's Sankofa the Wise Man and His Amazing Friend. That's it. Sankofa the Wise Man and His Amazing Friends.
I see. I might want to get that book.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll have to see if we can work that out. That would be great. Did you have any other thoughts about today's program? Justice, are you still there? Uh-oh. Might have lost her. Not hearing you. Not sure. Justice.asap@yahoo.com. That's her email address, justice.asap@yahoo.com. She might have dropped out, or she might have muted herself. The other folks, I think I got 909, Ebony News Channel, Sky Drifter is with us, and Non-Mighty Wick. Did you all have anything you wanted to share about today's broadcast or racism related?
Not at this time.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask them, but I guess I'll email them. And because you said you're going to have them back on the show, I was going to tell them to watch this. They have this new documentary out called South Africa, Shoot to Kill. You seen it?
No.
Yeah, they have their policy is basically, you know, shoot to kill. The crime, they say the crime is getting out of hand, so the government is taking an official stance that it's just, you know, don't ask no questions, you know what I'm saying, just shoot to kill. And in a documentary, they have black people saying that they were safer under the system of apartheid.
You know, you can pretty easily find white people from South Africa on YouTube complaining, claiming they're being discriminated against, et cetera, talking about all the crime. Actually did come across a blog, or I think it's like a news blog, that's supposed to be based out of South Africa some time ago, and they were talking about, you know, oh, black people are raping and killing white people nonstop, and it's only going to get worse because there's supposed to be some vow or covenant that the South African people have made, and when I say that, I'm excluding white people, but that the native South African people have, that once Mandela dies, they're supposed to slaughter all the white people or something like that. I don't know how true it is, but I read quite a bit about that online. So that seems like it's more of the, you know, fear baiting based on race and black violence that I hear coming out of South Africa. Hear a lot of white people talking about how bad it's become since they've had a black president.
They say that here too.
Yeah, exactly. It's common practice. That's that universal white culture, I think, which is the culture of white supremacy.
Yeah, I just couldn't believe, well, I was surprised that the black people were saying that. I mean, they did interview they call them Afrikaners or something like that. They interviewed the so-called white South Africans, and, you know, they were saying apartheid was better. They were saying that black people could walk the streets and feel safe, and that they weren't, you know, they weren't under any kind of, you know, pressure or, you know, just craziness. But to hear, you know, black people saying similar things, it was just, it was pretty shocking.
I could see that being the whole Hegelian dialectic thing, you know, the problem, reaction, solution, problem, oh, now that we don't have apartheid, you know, it's out of control, there's high crime rates, reaction, fear and chaos and, you know, oh, and pandemonium, and then solution, bring some type of restrictive white supremacist form of government back, or like you say, like the shoot to kill type of mentality.
Yeah, Africa's a lot of news coming out of Africa is just, Nigeria are killing young girls for witchcraft.
You know, it was on Dr. Kamau Kambone's Ning site or something, but he had an article on there. I found it pretty interesting. He was talking about the influence of outside religions upon African people and how, from the way he sees it, and he spoke about Nigeria and the clash between Christians and Muslims there, and he spoke about how these outside external religions that didn't come from us and that we didn't traditionally practice have come in and actually been the dividing points between us, and that we will kill each other over these religions that are not even our own. And his main point was the destructive nature of those upon African people and African culture. And you know, the whole thing about accusing children of witchcraft, a lot of that, those people are probably heavily influenced by Christianity. you know, labeling children witches and things. Just and I've seen that documentary. I don't think there's even a lot of evidence that they use against the children to claim that they're witches. We have the same type of witch hunts going on in colonial America, you know, from the Puritans, who were supposedly Christians. I just think there's a lot of dangerous ideology being pushed up on us. And I've noticed, too, I have a friend who is a musician, and he has a lot of friends that are musicians. He said he's noticed that it seems to be a great increase in so-called missionary work into Africa. His friends are increasingly going on tour, singing background with people like, let's say, Joyce Myers, who does her evangelical meetings over there, Martha Munizzi, Israel Houghton, you know, Christian artists like that. But I am seeing a growing number of huge movements of taking Christianity into Africa, and I don't see it into Europe at all. Even though someone said like 1%, someone said 1% of all Europeans go to church. Yeah, I think a lot of that definitely has to do with outside European influence, or to say white people, wherever they come from. Were you, 909, are you still there?
Yeah, did you ask me a question?
I'll just ask, were you still there? have you done any, looked into the African Union at all, or the Africa Union?
Yeah.
Did you notice, and I'm trying to think, is it the, I think what I saw just said Africa Union. I don't know if that's the same as the African Union. But what I saw online the other day was their president is a Chinese mulatto with the last name, I think it's Ping or Peng.
Hmm.
Is that the same? Have you seen that?
I don't know if that's what, I think they were talking about Gaddafi or being the president of the African Union. I don't know.
Okay, maybe this is something different, the Africa Union. Perhaps it's different, I'm not sure. But I just remember finding on a particular website a link that I went to, and it showed him he's one of his parents is an African, obviously, and his father, well, his mother, and then his father's Chinese. And I just thought about the dominant influence of China in South Africa, you know, being that other outside power. And Dr. Chancellor Williams, you know, book, The Destruction of Black Civilization, where he talks about the outsiders, including, I think at that time he was saying, white Asians coming in and producing the mulatto offspring, which would end up in leadership positions, acting as buffer class agents of the more powerful group.
I wanted to make sure I didn't lose Skydrifter. Skydrifter, are you still
here? Oh, no. I'm here, Gus. I'm here.
Making sure. Thank you, sir. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. How does the AU relate to AFRICOM, if at all? If anybody has any information on AFRICOM that they can share.
Everything that I've seen of AFRICOM shows that it's set up by white powers to basically bring a military occupation or military presence into Africa. I know it was definitely advocated by Bush, which is number one reason to be suspicious of it. It's not, AFRICOM is not, from my knowledge, in the control of African people. It's a setup by white people, perhaps with some black cohorts, basically to set up the military occupation of Africa. And from what I remember reading, someone theorized that they would use the ongoing warfare in places like Sudan, you know, the Arab warfare against black people and stuff, as a justification for going in with that military occupation to so-called bring peace over there and to squash terrorism. you know, with more of the Islamophobia stuff, but that eventually it would be a means to gain control of Africa's oil resources and other resources, especially in like Nigeria and Sudan. I would suggest visiting the AFRICOM website with a critical eye as you read.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking they have a lot of plans for Africa. I even was reading something about them trying to planning on building a bridge connecting Europe to Africa. And, you know, what you said as far as the, I think you said Chancellor Williams, and he had it right. I mean, you can see it all basically playing out, you know, just the buffer class, the missionaries going in there, and, you know, you can see it, like I said, it's going down right now. And I'm kind of excited to see where this all, you know, where this all is going. I don't know. I just for some reason I don't know why. I just have this. Even though, you know, justice. I mean, I'm working and doing what I need to do. But at the same time. You know, the forces that are at work, they're pretty powerful. You know, China and all these different Arabs, and it's just, you know, the miscegenation, and it's man. So what did Gus say? It's a what did you say? A well put together package. I don't know.
And to wait.
And then you go in and send vast amounts of missionaries with food, aid, and a white Jesus Savior in religion to make African people more dependent on white supremacy.
Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Give the question to 808.
818.
818. Thank you very much. 818. Would you say that this would be the last... force of bastion that the white supremacists will use in order to conquer Africa? Do you see that?
Do I see what is the last bastion?
Do you see this in terms of AFRICOM, in terms of them setting up bases within, you know, the African, you know, countries within the continent? Do you see that as the last swipe of the sword? Do you see this as a final attempt to gain full control of resources?
The final attempt, no, because I believe whatever they start, they finish, and I haven't seen them give up yet. So if that didn't work, I just think they'd keep trying, you know, everything else they've been doing, including disease, you know, causing natural disasters, breeding a larger mulatto population, religion. I just think they'll continue all of it unless African people wake up and put a stop to it. With the military thing, that one is the one that kind of troubles me the most, because outside of getting resources from China and maybe some Latin American countries like maybe Venezuela or something like that, I don't know where most African nations would get the resources to arm themselves against white supremacists. You know, especially because, if Africans had control of their mineral wealth and other resources exclusively, it wouldn't be an issue. But especially in South Africa, you have so much white and specifically Jewish control of the resources. The United States, I don't see them funding Africa. They give more money to Israel in U.S. welfare money than every other nation combined. So, I mean, I guess as far as from the area of having weapons and warfare and being armed to do violence against African people, AFRICOM could do the most direct harm as far as taking African lives and occupation. I don't know, but I think about the psychological level, too, of having a large population of so-called mixed children and more non-white, I mean, non-original African people in Africa, like white people, Asians, et cetera, people who may be loyal to white supremacy. I saw someone comment the other day on a video on YouTube, and I suppose it was a white person, but they were talking about all these women in Africa who they claimed were so, you know, oppressed and in need of husbands, and they were advocating getting green cards and work visas for all these women to come out of Africa en masse, you know, immediately. And it just smacked of that paternal, colonialist, we know better what you need, we're going to massively export you out, you know, like slavery, to control your lives and give you back into the hands of white men. You know, I still see that mentality among white people, the need to control what black people do and who they mate with. So I just see them coming from a lot of different fronts, and I haven't seen them ever stop with any of it. Like, I can go to an African restaurant near my house right now and speak to an African about Christianity or religion and then give me, you know, the screw face look and not want to talk to me anymore because they're so in love with white Jesus.
You mentioned that, I guess, people in non-white people in Africa, that if they wake up, they can, minimize the damage that's coming their way. I guess I was wondering, do you have anything specific in mind that that non-white people there, particularly, I guess, the black people, can wake up and do?
For one, I think a major hindrance is having white saviors or icons, I mean Christianity, because what I've noticed both here and there, now I see, like, let's say in Nigeria, I see Africans who are Christians fighting against Africans who are Muslims, but the main enemy to all of them is the system of white supremacy. So if they can wake up and see how those religions may keep white people in a place of where you can't recognize them as the enemy and do what you need to do in order to save your people, that's dangerous. If it's something that breaks up your unity and identity and allegiance to your own people, you know, that's a problem. If they could wake up, for one, I think the history, the destruction of black civilization, we don't continue to repeat the past as far as in educating ourselves about it, the history of our past, of our destruction. I don't think a lot of us analyze how it happened or how it came to be. I think we could spend less time cheering about being proud to be African and do the work that shows we're proud to be, which means protecting those things that are African. I think Africans could wake up and realize, despite the fact that many black people in America may feel themselves to not be African or have a colonized mind, if Africans could acknowledge and recognize that many of us, basically all of us, we do come from them at some point, you know, whichever of their tribes or ethnic groups that happen to be brought over in slavery, that we are still their people, if they would have the mindset to work with us, even to bring African cultures and ways of being, you know, values, family structures, if they were to bring that and ally with black people, even over here, just to teach the young people, I think it would make a big difference in the strength of African people worldwide. That divider, you're not us, we're not you, you're not real Africans, you know, y'all didn't come on cruise ships and rescue us from slavery. Like, if we could all just get out of that type of stupidity and realize we are the same people, you know, maybe with the exception of some interference from white supremacists, you know, culturally, somewhat genetically, but still, I consider us the same people. If we could recognize that we are throughout the world and we have a common plight, common oppressor, I think that would make a huge difference.
Can I explain something? Where do I work currently at the moment? So, yeah. Where I work currently at the moment,
there's an individual who happens to work alongside him. He happens to be Nigerian. And we, not long ago, we just got a new manager that started, in our cotton field. And he's basically, overseeing the store. Now, the Nigerian individual, I've been on holiday for some time. I haven't been at work. So I asked this, the co-worker, I asked him, what do you think of our new manager? Like, how do you think, how do you think he is? And he's a white man from South Africa. Huh? He said to me, this is his response. His response to me was that this manager is a black man in a white body. I asked him to repeat the answer. He repeated the same answer. I left it at that.
You mean a
the
white
level
man?
Of confusion. Hello?
I'm sorry, you mean a white man in a black man's body?
He said yes. He was a black man in a white man's body. That was his response to me. That was his level of confusion.
I'm sorry, you were saying the South African, the white South African manager?
The white South African manager. This is what my colleagues refer to me as, him being a black man trapped inside a white body.
The Nigerian
this is the
guy.
Level of confusion.
Yikes.
This is the level of confusion.
Why did he say that? Did you ask him what he meant by that?
I asked a few other members of staff, and they said, well, he's very easygoing, and, he doesn't cause any stress. Our previous manager never used to be on the shop floor. He was always pushing pen to paper. This manager is on the shop floor speaking to non-white females, laughing with them, speaking with them at the checkout, speaking to non-white males on the shop floor. And he's managed to gain their trust. He's managed to gain their trust wholeheartedly. Which to me, I'm just looking at all these individuals who are telling me, oh, this guy's great, he's such a great guy, and, there's nothing wrong, he'll never stab you in the back. He doesn't seem like that kind of individual.
He sounds heavenly, divine almost. Wow.
Sounds like the Tim Watt effect.
Very fine. How old would you say the new manager is, if you know or could surmise? What age?
No, I would not say he was any older than his mid-50s. He would have to be in his early 50s to mid-50s. He's very accommodating. He's very, he'll smile in your face and, he'll shake your hand and he'll ask you, personal questions, But a lot of non-white people who happen to be more confused are openly accepting of this behavior. And I've realized that a lot of people who are, quote unquote African, over here in the UK tend to be the same way. Tend to really be the same way. Very accommodating. We have a heavy, percentage of, Christian and Muslim faiths that are over here that happen, to be in a non-white community. And what I can say is that they are very, especially since coming from, the continent of Africa over here and settling down here, a lot of the people are just looking for acceptance. I've had numerous conversations with a lot of people who have just come over from the continent, and they don't really want to, if a lot of the information that I have acquired over these few, years in relation to white supremacy, if I share that information to these individuals, they totally look at me as a total different person, and they switch off, instantaneously switch off. So I'm wondering what kind of solution, because I've had many conversations with people, and they honestly feel as if
The only way out of this situation that we are currently in right now is if white people were to openly say to all non-white people, get out of our country, get out of our land. You are not desired here anymore. You know, we want total separation. That you know, that seems to be one of the only ways that, you know, people can only see us out of this situation right now. The level of confusion is so high. From, I'm not just speaking about, you know, non-white people that have been born in the UK. I'm talking about people from the continent of Africa. My father is Nigerian of the Yoruba tribe. My mother is Sierra Leonean of the Fulani tribe. I have spoken to so many people from Africa in relation to the system of white supremacy, and they honestly just don't want to talk about it. They don't want to speak about it.
I think I suspect it could have at least the people on your job, the non-white people you see on your job. It's like, it sounded to me like classic victim behavior. You know, we're always seeking to compensate or, you know, feel better. You know, white people do us dirty. And so when you see a white person trying to act all nice and accommodate and be friendly and kind, it's like, oh, yeah, this, you know, it's going to make my day. This is divine, if you will. I was going to ask, do you know, I guess if that white person, the manager, if he's, you know, married or, you know, in a relationship with anybody, and if that person is white or non-white?
I haven't fully engaged in any personal, I mean, I don't really know too much about his personal life, and he hasn't really, I've tried my best to stay very neutral in relation to my workplace. So I tend to kind of drift away, and, you know, I'm not really talkative when it comes to speaking with suspected voters. But, I wouldn't know.
Can I say something real fast? I just wanted to say, like when I said I was curious about what's going to happen as far as Africa is concerned, and really the whole global situation, but Africa in particular. I think it's going to. Hello.
Hello.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I see it going in a direction of full force. I mean, they unify Africa. I mean, it's pretty much that's the worst thing that they could possibly do is put them under some type of one governing body, and it looks like that's what they're trying to do. So they do that. I mean, that goes against every African principle that I've ever learned about. And there's examples of, you know, the European, the Euro, and all that unification that they got going on. That's what they want to do. But I'm just saying, if they do it, it's going to be bad for Africa. But I think when we're talking about solutions or whatever, that might be the thing that changes the minds of African people, because it looks like it's going to happen. So I'm just looking at it as maybe that's what's needed, is that, you know, once they come under that unification, which is going to be terrible for them, then a lot of people are going to die. But at the same time, then that might be the thing that you know, changes the minds of the people. So I wasn't saying that to be like some type of masochist or something, like, you know, like I want to see them, you know. Yeah, it's not a fun thing. It's not Hollywood. It's not a movie, you know. But they're not gonna just say we don't want the white Jesus no more. Not in their condition. Not when they're hungry. You know what I'm saying? So I just wanted to say that.
I don't know. I'm thinking the whole Africa Union thing is not completely in the control of African people. I think that might seal the deal and cement the doom of African people.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I don't know if that will. I don't think that would necessarily wake them up.
I don't know. I mean,
you gotta expect white people gonna make it sound. White people gonna make it sound like you know, sliced bread. They're gonna make it sound like it's an improvement.
Like it's, I mean, every aid for Africa, help for Africa. We are the worldism collective. We'll save all the starving people and from your despotic black inept rulers forever. You know, solution. And they'll probably, I mean, you got to think about the strategic use of someone like Barack Obama. I just watched a torturously hour and a half or 2 hour long special on Africa TV or the Africa Channel with people from Ghana praising Obama, a whole program. They have the Obama Hotel. They had children dressed in Obama African print clothing. Just, he's not from Ghana. He didn't even know his African father. He's from Kenya, but he's not even doing anything for black people here. He's not going to save Africans, but they, you know, it's that icon, that Trojan horse with the African phenotype. That's how I see it. And I can just see that being used against African people as a form of deception.
Ebony, I think... Yeah. One of the emails that I sent you, I actually made a statement that America itself, the U.S., is seen as the premier country worldwide for other non-white people to almost pay attention to and emulate. It sounds a bit way out there, but the whole world in regards to non-white, you've got young teenagers in Africa wearing two-pack t-shirts, putting two fingers up, and you've got people trying to be like Beyonce. You've got people who a lot of traditional values and mindsets have been taken away and stripped over time. And it's a process that I believe with this African thing, it's almost as if they're going to speed it up. It's almost as if here's a white supremacist, you know, here's an attempt to actually indoctrinate the whole of the continent, as well as certain, you know, as well as, you know, certain land regions, you know, which they've already done in the past. Here's their footprint. Here's their marker. And you know, I see full scale bloodshed, because you have a percentage of people who want to hold on to those values and traditions, as well as people who oppose the old values and traditions. So this whole African thing really about. It will really be about picking sides and choosing sides. You know, how I see it, you know, it will be about selecting what interests you want for African people worldwide or within Africa.
Does anyone know, are there any particularly black African nations that have strong military at this time?
Well, what do you mean by strong?
Like with the technology, training, organization, capability to defend their country in warfare. Like government, official, military.
Not against white people. Maybe
not about no say.
Not against white people. If I had my switchboard, I would have played the cricket sound.
Do you guys see any possibility of an alliance or friendship or support from other non-white leaders, like let's say Hugo Chavez, or I believe from a class I took a while ago, they were saying that during a particular struggle that what's his name, that Castro helped to arm Africans, and that was one of the reasons that the white supremacist leaders in the United States put an embargo against the country. But do you see any possibility of any unity or assistance from other non-white leaders like that?
If all the chips fall down and we came to critical mass, no. No. I don't see that. You're dealing with people who have military industrial complexes. They've got weapons of mass destruction. They've got biochemical, you know, laboratories where they deal with, you know, different types of, you know, viruses and, no.
I mean, white people war on so many levels that, you know, just having even, I would say, quote-unquote strong military, you know, it's not going to, I don't think that's enough because, you know, there's just too many other areas of activity that white people are warring in against non-white people to where, you know, we're going to need more than just might.
Yes, sir. That was a good point.
Sir.
So even in the irritated genie's proposed solution to the problem, you know, what I guess you'd say would be the most practical solution, how do any of you see that practically really being carried out by people who don't have the same military power or technological power and who are under a mindset, you know, of victimization? How does any of
you be incorrect? I could be incorrect, but I think he's talking, I guess what some may consider non-traditional tactics and our methods. So it wouldn't, you know, I could be wrong about that, but I guess it wouldn't be a formal, well, hey, you know, we know y'all coming against us, so we're going to meet in the middle and then let's battle. It isn't that type of thing.
It's going to have to be way non-traditional. I mean, we're going to really have to use some imagination about this because, I mean, I don't see that happening. Like a traditional, like, you know, all the black people get on this side and, you know, down with whitey. I mean, white people would obliterate that. Like that wouldn't even be, that would be like LeBron James going up against elementary school. You know, all the rowdy black and proud people, you know. Let's tell the truth. Like
handicapped elementary school.
Thank you. I mean, let's tell the truth. Like we lose every time. Matt Payne, I guess I need some damn self esteem, but you know, I would rather, you know, tell the truth, and we don't have anything to have a lot of esteem about. So I mean, it's gonna have to be real unconventional, real non traditional. You're gonna really have to use your imagination. But something has to be done, because I mean white people I think they're perfectly content to do this forever.
Because it's working for them.
Jay, it's what for them? I'm sorry.
I said because it's working for them.
Absolutely.
They just enjoy dominating. You know, they just enjoy it. They.
They're trying to survive.
That's it.
Do you all think that
makes sense?
Go ahead.
I was just going to put in the $400 for the 1 year that would allow 25 callers. We should get that. Again, that just goes directly to the white people at Blog Talk Radio. But 25 callers, lots of promotional tools would be a great investment in the cows. That's all. Go ahead, 818.
I was going to ask, do you all think the reported decline in birth rates among white people will contribute to the solution of that problem? Or do you think that white people would move to use some sort of technology like massive, you know, in vitro fertilization type things to try to reverse that, even though it's reported that it can't be reversed? But what do you think about that and its contribution to the solving of the problem?
Well, Mr. Neely Fuller said on the blog talk, he said that data is coming from white supremacists. Mm-hmm. So it might not even be the case, you know. So, yeah, you know, we don't know. So,
you think that may be propaganda to get them to panic and start reproducing more?
I mean, it's propaganda, definitely, because they're putting it out there.
Mm-hmm.
It could be propaganda just to get them to be more racist. Like, they could put that out, you know, just to get white people riled up.
Right.
So that they have that threat that, you know, oh my God, there's more of these darkies. We got to do something. We got to do something. Our numbers are shrinking. Even if whether it's true or not, that could be the purpose for it.
And you know what?
Because the way I would look at it too, I was just gonna say real quick is just that. I mean, even if I think if white people didn't have for sure methods of reducing the numbers of non-white people to a substantial degree very easily in you know, a matter of a day or a matter of hours, then I think they might be truly concerned about the reduction, if it's true, about the reduction of white people being born. But I think, you know, white people are pretty confident they can do 200,000 here, 150,000 here of non-white people, a couple of million here in a couple of months to where, you know, I don't know. I mean, it is 9/10 and it's 1/10, but you know, they can shake those numbers up real easy.
And stir them in.
Easily. Easily. And I wanted to make sure I got in. Very important. Race is not a biological concept. It's whatever white people say it is. The most powerful white people. White people could easily just snatch some of the non-white people who are a little more pale and say, you're now going to be white people. And they've done this before. Easily. So even if their numbers are, you know, whatever, we just reclassify a few folks and keep rolling. And I've had quite a few admitted racists say they think that's exactly what's going to happen with a lot of these so-called Latinos and a lot of the so-called Asians. And they're doing a lot of sexual intercourse with white people. So their offspring, exactly what our guest today talked about.
Have you all noticed an increase, those of you who do watch television, of TV shows marketing these large white families, let's say Big Love, which was supposed to focus on a Mormon family where there are multiple wives and children. You got the Dugards, which is a white family that has 19 children. There's one more family that they were associated with, and I can't remember their name. Then what is the other show? Well, you got John and Kate plus 8. He's supposed to be Jewish and Asian, I guess, and I suppose she's a white female. But that's 8 children there, and they seem to be fascinated with and constantly promoting them. But I know there are black people with large families, one particular family that has the only surviving sextuplets that are African-American in the United States. But you don't see any kind of promotion or opportunity or highlighting of that family come their way. But I'm just seeing it, you know, even like with the promotion of fertility treatment for white females, like in the newest movie with Jennifer Aniston, where she gets, I think she gets artificially inseminated to have a child. But, yeah, I just wanted to know if any of you have noticed the increase in that type of propaganda.
No TV.
I haven't seen much of it.
Okay.
I mean, what Gus just said was so, it was just so, think about that. They can make anybody white. So you never know if you have this elite group, these families that everybody likes to talk about, but we do know that they have an extraordinary amount of wealth. I mean, if they're trying to insulate themselves, that would be, I mean, to me, that's just so, it's a beautiful thing. Like, they can make anybody white. They're insulating themselves. All the rest of so-called white people aren't, they don't even consider them, these Irish, these Jews or whatever. Like, they're like, yeah, we made you white so you can do our work for us. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, if you guys do, you know, die off or whatever. We're gonna just bring in the next group. So what if they're like breeding? What if they're breeding people? You know, have these mulattoes or whatnot, because they're preparing for their next you know, white by law. You know what I'm saying? Their next group. Wow.
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm sorry. Were you still talking?
It could be. That would just shift black people further down the ladder. It would, you know.
I mean, you think they haven't considered that? You think they're not planning that? I don't see any indication that they haven't thought that. If we sitting here talking about it, I know for a fact the racist white supremacist has got that in the playbook.
I just wanted to add this when you talked about them making certain people or classifying certain people as white and they could take it away. I don't see that happening with the Jews for the simple fact that the Jew has become the ultimate white supremacist and, as someone I know put it, the dominatrix of white people, in the fact that they control the economy. Worldwide, they've gained a hold and gotten to a position of domination of nearly every area of people activity under the system of racism, white supremacy. And the thing they have that is a strength versus other white people is an extremely high amount of ethnocentrism and organization and loyalty because of this so-called race merged with religious ethnic identity. So I don't see them being discounted as white anytime soon, and even if they did it, I don't think they would care, because according to the Talmud, they're the only ones that are humans anyway, is those who are the Jews. And the rest of the goyim, or dumb cattle, are beasts that are in human form, so they can deal with them, according to the Talmud. So I don't see that group being kicked out or put at any disadvantage unless the rest of the white people really do some serious stuff and go to warfare with them.
I mean, that's the tight game strategy, you know. We the humans, y'all the beast, and then we know who to attack and demonize and everything else. I mean, hey, that's one way to get it done.
But that's their religious. In the book, Judaism is not based on the Bible. A lot of people have that misconception. It's wholly set about by rules from the Talmud. That's where the curse of Ham comes from, is the Talmud, where it says that Noah's son Ham was copulating with a dog on the ark. It's a lot of pornographic things like that in the book. But that he copulated with a dog and he was cursed to be black and ugly and his lips were swollen and his genitals too, and he twisted his neck to look upon his father's nakedness, so his hair was twisted. But the way that they run their commerce game and business is all outlined in that book. It's very shrewd. It's very pro them and anti everybody else, but that is what they've used to gain economic dominance. And I can't recommend it enough that every black person, and I'll say Asian people too, because it outlines what they did to Asians, but everybody must get the book, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 2, so you can see the economic game and how they've used labor, law, and economics to raise themselves up and disempower black people. And they tried to do the same thing to the Chinese. But the Chinese were just as ethnocentric as the Jews were. So they were able to be in a place of competitiveness with them. But they tried to do to the Chinese what they tried to do to the black. It didn't work as well, though. But I definitely would suggest reading that book, buying it and reading it. Buy a couple copies and give it to people you know. You can get it at the NOI.org website.
It makes sense to me. You tell your people what they need to hear to win. And I relate that to the last time the Irritated Genie was on. If anybody ever heard that, they should listen to that program.
Yep, it was an excellent broadcast. But I think it'd be very beneficial for us. For one, a lot of the power will come from self-sufficiency. He talked about how when the Chinese would come over, they may come over poor, but they would open up a shop. They would employ Chinese people. All their products would come from China. You know, they were self-sufficient, and whatever they got, it was putting money back into their community, back into nation building, you know, back home, and recycling that money. What a lot of black people don't realize, who don't want to work with other black people, you know, the divisions, things like that, a lot of us want to be where we see white people as being, but we don't want to do what white people did to get there, which was stick with each other. We'd rather go give all our money to them, but then we sit and wonder why we're in a position we're in. We want to have something, but we demonize us doing what other people have done to get there because we still have some sense of loyalty, I think, to the oppressor.
Well, that's the thing, see? You have to say, if there is one way to unify non-white people, it would be through economics. The only issue with the economics is that white people still determine the value of the money that you exchange. So it would have to be maybe a more primitive form of exchange in relation to trade and barter. But that's, you know, I've raised this a few times as well with non-white people, you know, economics bringing us together, which is great. You know, it's great. Although, you know, we are like right now, on an economic scale, we are at the bottom. But again, we are dealing with the confines of reality that these people put in order. So it would have to be something brand new, something totally, you know, fresh out of the box.
Gonna need lots of imagination to solve this problem. We will be back on Sunday, September 5th, 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, her sixth visit to the cows. London time, 11 p.m. London time, 11 p.m. Justice's email, justice.asap@yahoo.com. Again, justice.asap@yahoo.com. Thank you all for tuning in. Context of White Supremacy, End of Summer Blackout. I think Mr. Grant, outstanding illustration of why the cows ran exactly as, or why the cows has run the way it has, starting with lots of white people. Now we can do the non-white people. And for anybody, if this broadcast sounds crazy, please go back and listen to some of the white folks. If I had to recommend, I would say maybe start with the first time Dr. Martin Kevorkian was here, May of 2009. Another white person to check out, Tim Wise. Tim Wise, January 28th, 2010. Check those two out if you want to start with some white people that have been here and what they have to say. We'll be back this Sunday, Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing. Thanks so much. And the cows, signing out. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately.